The middle part of the book that we're looking at now is the most depressing part. It's also the longest part, which I don't think is fair. In terms of chapters, it's 35 chapters long. The debate that goes on, it's written in Hebrew poetry, which is very difficult to translate into English. Any poetry in any foreign language is difficult to translate into English and get the feel of it. So it winds up just sounding very repetitious. Now, don't get me wrong, there are many good things we can learn, and we've already learned the short period that we have been looking at this passage. But here's something I want you to keep in mind as well as we go through this. All 35 chapters of this endless debate of Job's friends who can't get it out of their mind that Job's trouble has any reason except that he's got sin in his life. He's not admitting it, because if he was really right with God, none of these bad things would be happening. People still think that way. And one of the valuable things about the book of Job is, though it is the oldest book in the Bible, and people are still saying the same wrong things about God that they did way back then, God himself intervenes at the end of this book and says, wrong, 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 wrong. You're all wrong. Everything that you said about me was wrong except for what Job said. So all 35 chapters of hearing all of the wrong opinions and Job defending himself against guys that have got to be in their bonnet thinking that he's got sin in his life and he's not admitting it, and that just makes him madder the more he defends himself. All of that 35 chapters takes place in about 24 hours. In fact, all of Job's suffering, as horrible as it was, as unbearable as it must have been, that whole part of the story only lasted at the most about 2 weeks. And the first part of Job's life was filled with God's blessing. And chapter 42 says that God turned everything around and blessed Job's life more than it had been blessed in the beginning. And Job lived after these events 140 years. In God's blessing. But you know how the whole time warp thing happens when you're suffering? It's like, this is forever, my whole life's going to be like this, and the days just drag on and drag on. And of course, if you've gone through a really hard time like that and come out the other side, you realize it wasn't as bleak as you thought it was going to be. And we are so vulnerable to lies when we're suffering. And I wanted you to see, we saw Job's response when in about 5 minutes' time, he lost everything. And his first knee-jerk reaction was he fell down and he worshiped. And then his wife came along when Job broke out with this horrible disease, disfiguring, painful disease. His wife told him, just curse God and die. And even then, he didn't turn against the Lord. He seemed to have everything pretty much under control. Until his friends came along. And everything they say just made it worse. What's the valuable thing we can learn? We agreed last night at the Rockland study that the most powerful thing we are learning from the middle part of this book is how to not treat people who are suffering. And we also agreed that we all of us had said things we shouldn't have said, because we didn't know what we were talking about. We weren't feeling the pain. We weren't the ones suffering. And we offered little platitudes that didn't apply, or just flat out were accusing, like Job's friends were. And of course, you can't take words back, but you can learn to not be that way. And sometimes going through the pain yourself of being misunderstood and makes you a little cautious about throwing your opinion out at people. So we saw Job's three friends, Eliphaz, Bildad, and Zophar. We saw them traveling from quite a ways, and they came. Their original intent was to come and sit with him and comfort him. They did sit with him. They sat with him for a whole week, and they didn't say one word. But then when Eliphaz began to speak, he just came out guns blazing, and he launched an attack on Job and said, basically, this is all your fault. Stuff like this doesn't happen to good people. Yeah, you look like a good person for a while, but the way everything came crashing down, obviously, you're not right with God. You've been a phony all these years when we all thought you were a godly man. And now you need to admit that so this will all go away. And we stopped last week at chapter 6, which was where where Job has an opportunity to defend himself against these charges by Eliphaz. He takes a couple of chapters. I have to tell you, it is kind of depressing. There are good things to learn from it. It's just depressing because so many of the things that he says sound so familiar to me. I've said some of the very same words that he said. I want you to look at one thing before I read, and we just start taking this chunk by chunk. Look over in chapter 7, in verse 7. Easy to remember, 7:7. And look at what he says. Remember that my life is but a breath. And this is when he's just pouring out his agony. And he says, my life, my eye will never again see good. Hold that thought. Because less than 24 hours from Job saying that, his whole life changed. And not only did he see good again, he saw good for 140 more years. Do the math. How many days is that? A huge portion of his life was way more blessed even than the first portion of his life, which was blessed. Hold that thought, because I guarantee you, at some time in your life, things are going to look bleak, and you're going to look into the future, and the devil's going to predict your future. He's going to tell you, you know, it's going to get bad. You better look back on all the good stuff you had, because you're never going to have any good stuff again. Lies, lies, lies. And that's the advantage of history. We know what's going on. Job had no idea why this was happening, but we get to see the whole story. We get to look all the way over to the end, see what God did. But I wanted you to keep that timeline in mind, because while he's pouring out his opinion, why there's all these dire predictions from his friends, he's less than one day away from it all changing. And that's an important perspective to keep in mind. So hang on to your little handout there that says that for a godly person, all suffering is temporary and all disappointment with God is premature. Now, that presupposes that godly people will suffer. As much as people would like to cut holes in their Bible, the Bible really does say that godly people do suffer. The prime example is Jesus himself. But God only allows suffering in the life of godly people if he's got a higher purpose. And even then, it has limits, both in duration and in degree. So it presupposes godly people will suffer, and it also presupposes that godly people are going to be disappointed with God from time to time. Things are just not going to work out the way you thought they did. So hang on to those two little statements, because it's not going to feel like they're true at some point in your life, but they are true. And once again, you back off and you get the time perspective in this, and you realize that All these words of agony, all these wrong words of criticism from his friends, all the words of self-defense, all of it only lasted a very short period of time and only added to his grief. There's a lot to be said for just, as Max Lucado says, it's not over till God says it's over, to just not jump to conclusions based on what you see right now, because the next chapter could be fabulous. So let's begin reading. Eliphaz finishes his eloquent attack and his dire predictions, and here's Job's defense. And remember, it's Hebrew poetry. It is a little bit awkward. Before I read this, let me give you one other little hint. Here's what I do. I have a Message Bible at home and a New Living Translation at home. Read the book of Job in one of those two, because they made the effort to not be linguistically accurate to the Hebrew poetry. And so it's a lot easier to understand what it's saying. I'm not using them because they're not actual translations, and we're trying to stick to the word. I'm using my New King James. So Job answered Eliphaz and said, "Oh, that my grief were fully weighed." In other words, you don't feel what I feel. If you'd taken that into account, you wouldn't have attacked me. "And my calamity laid with it on the scales, because then it would be heavier than the sand of the sea. And therefore, my words have been rash." He's saying, look, I know when I poured out my grief, when you gave me that 7 days of silence and I finally told you how I was feeling, I know I was speaking wild words, but that's because of my pain. I wish you understood my pain. Because the arrows of the Almighty are within me, and my spirit drinks in their poison. Were they the Almighty's arrows? No, they weren't. God was not the one that caused the suffering. Satan was the one that caused the suffering. "The terrors of God are arrayed against me. Does the wild donkey bray when it has grass, or does the ox low over its fodder?" In other words, he's saying, look, of course I make a noise. I'm unhappy. I'm not content. What do you expect? If you knew my pain, you'd understand. "Can flavorless food be eaten without salt, or is there any taste in the white of an egg?" In other words, what he says is, Eliphaz, your words are inedible. There's no nourishment in what you just said. My soul refuses to touch them. They're as loathsome food to me. That big, long speech you gave, Eliphaz, did me absolutely no good whatsoever, and you wouldn't have said half that stuff if you were feeling the pain that I'm feeling. "Oh, that I might have my request. Oh, that God would grant me the thing that I long for, that it would please God to crush me, that he would loose his hand and cut me off. Then I would still have comfort, though in anguish I would exult. He will not spare, for I have not concealed the words of the Holy One." In other words, what he's saying, have you ever felt so bad that you just wanted to die? I don't mean just feeling sorry for yourself momentarily, but I mean being in a hole so deep that you just wanted to die. I have. I have been at that point in my life. I prayed to die every day for a couple of weeks. Aren't you glad God doesn't always say yes to our prayers? At the time, we're usually not glad. At the time, we think, God, if you love me, you give me what I want. And sometimes later on, you realize that it's a good thing he doesn't. It's a good thing that he says no. By the way, no is a loving answer to prayer. If you're God and you know everything, would it have been better for Job if he would have died right then and gone to heaven? Well, of course it would. But that wasn't the reason he was praying, kill me. He wasn't praying, kill me so I can go to heaven. He was praying, kill me because I hate my life. And God had a different plan. The plan was God was going to bless Job's life, and this whole story was going to be a testimony of what happens when somebody doesn't give up their faith in God, even when they're suffering. And it would benefit hundreds upon hundreds of thousands of people, including us today. So God had a better plan, and that required that he said no to Job's prayer. Verse 11, "What strength do I have that I should hope?" I love the Amplified Bible says, "What strength have I left that I should wait and hope? What's ahead of me that I should be patient?" Or what's the whole point? Why stick around? That's not a bad question to ask, I think, sometimes, as long as you don't let the devil answer it. As I look at that point in my life, the worst day of my life when I wanted to be dead and I planned to be dead and I took all the steps that I could to be dead, 1985. And God intervened so that I wasn't dead. And all I could see for weeks and weeks ahead of me was that I couldn't see any point in living. That didn't seem like there were, under any circumstances, could I ever have a life that was worth living. Do you know the day after that day, my whole life changed? I'm looking down this road, and as far as I can see, it's bleak. What I didn't know was that 24 hours, God was going to take a hard left, and the road that he was going to take me down the very next day is the road that I've been on now for 15 years. Is it 15 years or 25 years? 25 years. So don't let the devil predict your future. You make really bad decisions. Once again, remember, he's crying out to Eliphaz for what a worthless advice he's been giving. Verse 12, and he's saying, is my strength the strength of stones, or is my flesh bronze? Is my help not within me, and a success driven from me? In other words, he's saying, what do you think I am? Would you do any better if you were in this situation? I'm doing the best that I can. I'm grabbing a hold of my confidence in God, but I expected better from you. Verse 14, to him who is afflicted, kindness should be shown by his friend, even though he forsakes the fear of the Almighty. In other words, he's saying, even if I did temporarily lose sight of God, you're my friend. You should have pointed me to God with sympathy and not blasted me with criticism. I've discovered this by experience, that you can tell who your true friends are, not by when you win the lottery. Everybody wants to be your friend then. You can tell who your true friends are when you lose everything, when you're suffering, when your life doesn't make sense. And there are some people that will come and stand beside you, and even if they can't figure out what to say, if they're godly friends, they'll point you to him. They won't just land on you. And I have had both kinds of friends in misfortune in my life. I've had people that all they wanted to do was do what Job's friends did here and lecture me on what a loser I was, and I needed to get right with God. And other people that would stand beside me. And Job says, look, I had a right to expect better from you, Eliphaz. Over the next 8 verses, he uses some very poetic imagery to talk about his 3 friends. He addresses all 3 of them. It's beautiful imagery. Once again, it's Hebrew poetry, so it might be a little awkward. It's not the way that you would talk. But the picture's a good one. Picture the Judean desert. Remember when we went through the Judean desert, Sandra and Edgar and all you guys that went to Israel? We're down in this desolate part of the country that gets less than 2 inches of rainfall a year. And as we're driving down the highways that are built over the top of the Roman roads, that are built over the top of the camel caravan dirt tracks, our guide told us that all of the roads in that part of Israel are all built around one thing: water. If there's a spring, if there's a year-round stream, if there's fresh water in a lake, the road goes that way. And however it has to wind. And so the imagery that Job is giving of his friends over the next 8 verses, he's saying, you know, right when I needed refreshment, I came to you guys and I found a dried up well. I found a dried up stream. I should have expected better. Of course, they didn't have anything to say because they didn't really know God. They didn't know Job's pain. They had no sympathy. They were just spouting off religious platitudes. And listen to what Job says. My brothers have dealt deceitfully, like a brook, like the streams of the brooks that pass away, which are dark because of the ice and into which the snow vanishes. But when it's warm, they cease to flow. When it's hot, they vanish from their place. The paths of their way turn aside and they go nowhere and they perish. They just fizzle out. The caravans of Tema look, and the travelers of Sheba hope for them. but they are disappointed because they were confident, and they come there and they're confused. Imagine you go 50 miles out of your way in the dead of the summer just so that you can save your the lives of your livestock and the lives of your companions, and you come to the place where the spring's supposed to be, and you get there and you think, there's always been water here. Now I need, right when I need it, when our lives are at stake, now there's no water. I think it's a very good picture that Job is using to describe his friends. Our first little rabbit trail. Flip over to Psalm 84. It's the next book over. Hang a right and go over to Psalm 84. Because as I was thinking about this, the whole dried up well concept, the whole going to people for refreshment to save your life and finding that there's no water in there, it reminded me of the Psalm 84, written by the sons of Korah. It was one of the psalms that were sung when the pilgrims made their way from all parts of Israel up to Jerusalem. Most of them came on that desert road. They came up from the south, from Gaza, or they came down from the north, but they came right down that same valley that we drove down. And then when they got to Jericho, they would turn right and they would head up the windy, windy, windy road. But a lot of their travel was through wilderness. And this psalm was a psalm that they sang. I'm gunning for verse 7. That's verse 6, excuse me. How lovely are your dwelling places, O Lord of hosts. My soul yearns, even pines, is homesick for the courts of the Lord. My heart and my flesh cry out and sing for joy to the living God. And then he talks about, man, it'd be cool to just be a sparrow and build my nest right there so I could just live there. Happy are those who dwell in your house there, and they will always be praising you. Happy is the man whose strength is in you, whose heart is set on pilgrimage. And here's the verse I was looking for. As they pass through the valley of Baca, they make it a place of springs, and the rain covers it with pools, and they go from strength to strength, and each one appears before God in Zion. Baca, that is an actual place, but it was named the place of weeping. That's what the Valley of Baca means. It means the Valley of Weeping. You have two choices when you go through the wilderness in the place of weeping on your journey. As you're growing in the Lord on your way to your Heavenly Father's house, everybody's going to go through the Valley of Weeping. You just have a choice of what you do when you're there. He said the happy people are the people who dig wells. And they dig wells not just for their own refreshment, but when they dig the wells, everybody that's behind them, everybody that travels that same road is going to be refreshed. And the language of verse 7 in there is saying, and everybody's going to reach that place of being in the presence of the Lord that they were setting out for, because they didn't faint on the way. And the reason they didn't faint on the way is that when you were in the Valley of Weeping, you dug a well. I remember hearing my brother teach on this one time. He's a lot funnier guy than I am and a much better teacher than I am. But he talked about falling on your lips because you're so worn out. And he said, laying there on your lips in the sand, digging a well with your nose. He said, if that's what you have to do, don't just lay there. Dig a well. Dig down. Find the water. And dig it deep enough so not only will you be refreshed, but the people who follow after you will be refreshed. Chuck used to say, suffering either makes you a better person or a bitter person. And it's all up to you. It's all up to how you respond. Usually we get extremely self-centered when we're suffering. It's all about me. Come and let me tell you about my pain. Now, up to a point, we need that. That's part of grieving. But there's a point where we need to dig a well. We need to find some of that living water, not only to nourish us, but to leave that behind. So that we don't become like Job's friends, that when he really needed refreshment, they didn't have anything to say. They didn't actually know God. All they knew was popular theology. And later, when God